From Simon & Schuster, a new book called Promises of Power, a political autobiography called B. Stokes. I think everybody has heard about Carl Stokes in two ways. First, his political career culminating with his election and re-election as mayor of Cleveland. To me, it was even more interesting how he ascended the political ladder and how he got along with various elements in Ohio. He was the first black state legislator ever elected, which I just found inconceivable in a state like Ohio. And now, of course, he's been with NBC here in New York. Carl, I found it very interesting that you went from politics to radio or television. There seems to be a trend of that. In fact, some people always say that maybe Lindsay will end up the same way. What do you think?
Well, I doubt if Lindsay will end up the same way. I'm not sure that any of the stations particularly have asked for his services. But I found a great deal of similarity between professional politics and news media. After all, those two areas are intertwined. The press really owes its constitutional freedoms to its role as monitor of politics. Well, necessarily to, or government, I should say, well, necessarily to monitor something, you have to be there with it. And as a consequence, the politicians and newsmen have always had a very close interdependent relationship. Adversary relationship, to be sure, but nonetheless, sometimes it's very difficult to tell the difference between the two.
Well, having spent 10 years myself running for office, nowhere near as successfully as you did, I find that, you know, there's an equal amount of excitement in each of the two, you can almost say, branches of media or power. But that you, as if you're working in radio or television, you don't have to spend all that wasted time that you do in politics, the going to the affairs, the shaking of hands, the sitting down listening to everybody. Don't you sort of feel at least that you're more your own man in communications than you were in politics?
Well, not only that you're more your own man, Casper, but you really feel for the first time some freedom and you feel some privacy. And it's very difficult to try to explain to the average American what privacy means. The ability to go out and have dinner and not have to worry about some fellow walking out of the restroom and walking up to you as you're eating your dinner and stick his hand over your plate and say, hi, and you've got to shake his hand. Because,
who was that woman you're with?
Yeah.
It'll be
or
on the front page the next.
That's right. It's incredible, and I'm glad that at this stage of my life that I'm able to come into journalism. I could not have earlier because, in a great sense, as you know, being in radio and television, you're an observer. You're really reporting what others are doing, and I've just been too much of an activist as a younger man. I doubt if I could have comfortably been in the news profession then.
Well, I mentioned when I was introducing you that you were the first black ever elected to the legislature.
First black Democrat.
Yeah, Democrat in the state of Ohio. How can a thing like that happen in a large state like Ohio? If someone had asked me that, I would have said it was incredible.
Well, Democratic Party of Ohio just never nominated any black men. Now, they would have token candidates on their endorsed slate, but they would never elect them. For instance, when you had the great sweeps of Roosevelt, you would have thought that the Democrats in Ohio could have carried anything. Or, for instance, Truman carried Ohio. And you would have thought that in Cuyahoga County, in which Cleveland is located, and Cleveland votes 24% of all the votes in Ohio, you would have thought that the way that John F. Kennedy carried our county, which was by around 250,000 votes, that they would have swept in some blacks, but they didn't, and never did, until I came along. And one of the things that the white Democrats used to always advise the black candidates was, don't go out in the neighborhoods. Don't let the white people vote, see you, because then they won't vote for you. Well, that's ridiculous. If they don't see you, don't know who you are, why should they vote for you?
Now, that's true. You broke all those barriers, Carl Stokes, and you describe it in Promises of Power, but there was one disturbing thing about that sort of campaigning. You did go out in white neighborhoods, and you did get a percentage of white votes, and it's sort of that old story that it isn't necessary to get 50%, but if you get 15 instead of 5, that can be the difference in victory. But one thing that bothered me was that you admitted in the book that you use different kind of literature for blacks and whites. Isn't that right. Sort of like a presidential candidate talking one way in Atlanta and another way in New York?
Why, sure, Casper. Of course it is. You know, you can't deny it.
Give me an example of what you did. How blatant was, were you?
Well, you know, we had to do some mailings in the white areas. And so realizing what right white prejudice is, I have no problem as long as I can appear before white people and let them see me and let them listen to me, et cetera.
Intelligent and so on.
But when they have to receive my picture in the mail and all that they see is a black guy there, I know that the average white person given the choice around America generally isn't going to vote for a black candidate, just the way that this country is. As a consequence, what we did was to take a picture of me, since we had to do mailing, and we underexposed the picture so that I came out much
lighter.
Just
a little sunburn.
Just a little sunburn. Yeah. And then the photographer retouched out my mustache, because mustaches are associated with blacks generally.
I never knew that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about all the black people, black men, you know, and most of them have mustaches. And until lately, very few white men had mustaches, until beards came into vogue. And then she raised my hairline a little, you see. And when it came out, it wasn't a white man, but it wasn't a black man either.
Practically had you looking like Uncle Sam.
Yeah. And so we mailed that into the white areas in order to get the name Carl Stokes out there. And I must admit that it was... I don't know. I guess it came within the category of dirty little tricks.
Well, Carl, when you talk that when someone gets something in the mail and they won't vote for a black man, you sound a little suspiciously like the person that would say in 1960, if you get something in the mail, they won't vote for a Catholic like John Kennedy, or they won't vote for a Greek like Agnew or something like that. Do you think you're being oversensitive on that today?
Today?
Yeah, because look at all the black men that have been elected to... high office in white areas.
Well, now you look at them.
Well,
for instance, where?
Well, the various mayors that were just elected.
let's take each one of them.
All right, what about Atlanta?
All right, in Atlanta, Maynard Jackson, who unquestionably is head and shoulders over Sam Massel. I know Sam Massel personally, served with him when he was deputy mayor. Maynard Jackson got 20% of the white votes.
That's a pretty big piece, isn't it?
Well, it isn't a pretty big piece when you have a candidate like Sam Massel that went around literally preaching race hate during that campaign.
You mean in so many words?
Yeah, in so many words. Sam didn't come out and say vote against these black people, but he, by using such things as saying Atlanta will not survive if Maynard Jackson and Hosea Williams, Hosea was running for president of council, are elected. Why? Well, because they were both black. He didn't say that Hosea wasn't a qualified man to be president or president of council, or that Maynard wasn't a qualified man to be mayor. What he was saying was the reins of government will be in the hands of these two black men, mm-hmm. and Atlanta will go down. Why? Suppose they'd been Jewish. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have said that. Or if they'd been old white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, he wouldn't have said that. In Detroit, 90% of the whites voted for the white former police commissioner in Detroit, who had none of the training that Coleman Young had. After 15 years in the state legislature,
the majority got 10% of the white
only vote. Got 10% of the white vote. You see, now you could say, well, what about Los Angeles? Now in Los Angeles, there's only an 18% black population, and Tom Bradley was elected mayor out there earlier this year. But my goodness, Casper.
Look who he was running.
That's right. There isn't a person in the United States did not know how sorry a mayor Sam Yorty was. And the vote there was very low, and the what would be considered as the conservative vote, the real identifiable anti-black vote just didn't come out and vote at all, because they weren't going to vote for Tom Bradley, and they had been disabused about any kind of usefulness any longer from Sam Yorty. So it's anti-Semitism, anti-black, and class prejudices are very much a part of the fabric of this country.
Carl Stokes, how long ago was it that the incident took place in your life where you tried to get your child into a kindergarten or early grade school in Cleveland where they had never had a black? And perhaps you'd tell our audience about
that. Sure. That was 10 years ago in 1963. I was serving my first term in the state legislature and had been a very active man. One of the real ways that I got elected to the legislature was being very involved in the civic and community affairs of Cleveland, working with some of the top industry and businessmen. It turned out that many of the top business and industrial figures in our city also served as members of the board of directors of a large private school just outside the boundaries of Cleveland in the fashionable Shaker Heights area. The name of the school was called University School. And I lived in a neighborhood in which the schools had just steadily run down. And as a boy who's grown up in Cleveland and had been a dropout myself, and knowing what education means to a young boy, I just figured that the one thing I was going to try to leave my child was a good education.
You were thinking exactly the way a white person would think in similar circumstances. Weren't you a member of the legislature then?
Yes, I was a member of the legislature.
So they did the same thing. They found the schools unacceptable, and they sent their children to private school.
Yes,
they were trying to do the same.
That's a fact. Okay. My wife went out to enter our child in this school, which is only about 4 miles from our home. And they just frankly told her, "We don't accept Negroes here." That was just 10 years ago.
You might tell them about the letter, too.
Well, I will.
Yeah.
So when I got back, I insisted that they accept the application. When I got back from the state capitol. They did accept the application. But then what they did was there was another black couple who had apparently applied at the same time we did. The name of that couple was Sanford Davis, who had grown up with me and who was now a physician, in fact, a renowned surgeon. And they had applied for their son. Well, the school sent letters to Dr. Davis and to me. The only thing was that it was the same letter, but they were so careless that they had sent the letter intended for me to Dr. Davis for his son, and Dr. Davis's letter to me, which I thought really capped it all off.
A bit of Freudian in there, too, about putting you down, you know, by not even caring whose letter you got.
That's right, because they were saying to both of these black people, don't care who you are, whether you're a state legislator or whether you're a renowned physician, we're not going to let your kids in. And Casper, you see, that did not go at all to whether or not the kids could function at that level. Certainly had nothing to do with the economics of it. It was just a strict racial thing. Well, then, when I received that letter, of course, I was boiling at the fact not only that they just reject the boys on the basis of the fact that they were black, but my goodness, to even not even send the correct letters to each other. I then wrote them a letter in which I promised each of the big industrialists and businessmen on that board that whenever they spoke again at these public luncheons in Cleveland about how they were for fair play and equality of opportunity, that I would feel it incumbent on me to let everybody know that it just isn't so, that they live one life inside Cleveland and then they go out and perpetuate segregation and discrimination in this suburb. When that letter went out, my telephone started ringing, and all of a sudden, the school found a reason that they wanted Carl Jr. to become a pupil at their school. And we went out, took him back out there, and they said that they had reconsidered this and that there were very compelling reasons for Carl to be in there that had nothing to do with anything but Carl's ability and that they wanted to do this. And so they accepted Carl, and now 10 years later, every grade in that school is has a number of black students, and they send out all sorts of brochures telling prospective applicants about their balanced integrated program and how the enrichment that it provides students in. And they're now leaders among the private schools in accepting young black youth.
Well, Carl Stokes, you haven't made the board yet, though, have you?
No, and frankly, whenever I returned to the school on a parents' night, they were always very cool to me.
Well, one would think that, you know, they had finally outgrown that sort of thing. And
well, they have, and I always, whenever you break open the doors, there's going to be some residual resentment against you, and I've just learned that to be true. Let's take, for instance, in this book, Promises of Power, Casper, I tell about the way that I fought to reform the police department in Cleveland. Now, there isn't a person, any citizen, who doesn't know that there are some things about every police department that needs reform. Most policemen, just like most politicians, are basically honest people. But in each one of those professions, there are some bad people. And in my efforts in fighting for reform of the police department to try to open it up to black and Puerto Rican citizens of that city, I encountered not only great resistance and resentment from the police department, but resistance and resentment from the majority white community, who responded to the police's defense of saying Carl Stokes is trying to interfere with the police department. And the white community view the police department as their protection against the black scourge. And you must remember, this was during the time of the riots, and white communities around the nation were fearful about the blacks. And then there's been the black movement into the formerly all-white areas, and all of that tension was the kind of things that I and other mayors during that period had to contend with, that Casper, I might say to you, mayors today don't have to contend with. It's almost like those of us who presided over the cities from, let's say, 1960 to about 1972, were at a unique interval in the urban life of our city, of our country. The mayors prior to that had as a basic job that of picking up garbage and rubbish and seeing to it that police and fire protection was provided. Mayors today preside over cities that you rarely now hear about any kind of rioting. They've basically gone back to the old fundamentals of garbage and rubbish pickup, trying to stop any block busting. They talk about war, air and water pollution now. They talk about mass transit now. But in the 60s, we had to contend with rioting. We had to contend with a vigorous revolutionary spirit that was hitting not only in the black and poor white areas, but on in the public schools and on the campuses of the universities in our cities, and all of the political upheaval that was going on, and the reactions of people to the assassinations of President Kennedy and Bob Kennedy and Martin Luther King. A very, very unique period of time that you just don't find having to be faced now by the mayors generally around the country.
Carl Stokes, throughout the political career which you worked so assiduously, or let's say seriously,
all right,
and you describe Promises of Power, you keep thinking about going on and upward and so forth, now the word senatorial post, governorship, so forth, yet you left all this and went with NBC television. What was behind this switch?
Well, two things. First, I can dispose of the NBC thing fairly quickly. I had decided in March 1971 not to run for re-election. And so I left politics formally in November 1971.
You left the mayoralty.
I left the mayoralty, and well, I made made it clear that I was leaving the field of organized politics, that I felt I had gone as far as I could, and I felt that I had contributed as much as I could. And then the next year, about 7 months later, NBC, that was, they were looking around the country for prospective anchormen and asked me to come to New York and audition, and I did, and they accepted me, and then I went into training to become an anchorman. I'm still training. Now, before that, Casper, what had happened was, even though I've had probably some successes as a politician that will remain as historical firsts, yet I'm not sure how much of a politician I was, as it was that I used politics for sociological purposes. I'm fundamentally a person committed to social reform. And presiding in office really has never been an allurement to me. Being in political office has always meant to me, what change can you affect? What reform can you bring about? And as a consequence, I have always served in public office in the most unpolitic way, which works pretty well when you're in a fairly anonymous body like a legislature. But when you're the executive and all eyes are focused upon you and your movements are magnified, etc., then you have to make the decision of whether or not, continuing in office, you're going to be able to effect change. If you cannot, then unless you're one who just wants to be in office, then you ought to get out.
Couple of questions. We have about 4 minutes left. Carl Stokes, wasn't the recent appointee of the president's from Ohio, and did you know him?
I knew Bill Saxby well.
Yeah.
I served in the legislature with Bill Saxby. He was Speaker of the House at that time, and then he was elected United States Senator and was Senator while I was mayor. And while I was mayor, Bill Saxby helped a great deal in getting federal funds into Cleveland. My prediction is that other than the politics, the presidential politics that's going on right now, Bill Saxby will meet every test that the senators may place upon him and will be found to be a clean man politically. And as Attorney General of the United States, I think this country would be very lucky to have him. Very tough guy, very smart guy, very committed man, and one who will basically administer his office in an even-handed manner.
Were you attempted at all to try to be the governor of Ohio? I'm trying to remember in political history when the last black governor of a state, has there been anybody since Reconstruction?
No, there hasn't even been any. There was at least one governor and about two lieutenant governors during the Reconstruction period. Since that time, there hasn't even really been a serious attack mounted on either of those two offices, except Basil Patterson here in New York
when he ran
years ago, lieutenant governor.
Well, that's not
so. There was one man, Art Fletcher did. No, it wasn't Art Fletcher. There was a black guy who did run for lieutenant governor out in the state of Washington about 5 years ago, but I don't think that was a very serious effort. There will be one launched this year by a Los Angeles city councilman by the name of Billy Mills, who has advised us that he will run for lieutenant governor. In my own case, I would say this to you. I never aspired to it. I happen to believe that in the exercise of power, there are only two positions that really exercise it directly, and that is the mayor of a major city and the president of the United States. And once you have been one of either, anything else really is almost secondary. For those of us who are activist persons who want to be able to put our hands upon the problem and deal with it directly.
You don't think that the challenge and the fact of what it would mean to blacks all over the country, if not the world, of having a black governor would be worth it?
If you could do it, if you could achieve it, and if you're the kind of person that would be interested in being governor, it would be. But it also could be a bad thing. For instance, I happen not to think that Shirley Chisholm's race for the president last year was a worthwhile.
Well, effort. I agree with you on that. And she was right here in this room, as a matter of fact, but I didn't say that to her.
Well, I've said it to her, and it served no political worthwhileness, and what it did do was to divert attention from the crucial aspects of that presidential race last year, divert attention, and perhaps dampen some of the enthusiasm that some of the black voters would have had for what was the real contest.
Yeah, you were for Humphrey because you felt he could win.
I knew he could win. Mm-hmm. No question about it. If the people who should have voted for Humphrey had voted for him, he would have won. But whenever this minority group people just cannot afford to gamble with the top offices that mean so much to their welfare. You know, in letting someone go on an ego trip.
Is much more important than
absolutely
getting a black to be running for the presidency.
In if you're having a black running for the presidency on an ego trip, which is what Shirley Chisholm was doing.
One last question. Did this leave you as sort of an enemy of McGovern's?
Not at all. I sent Senator McGovern a book the other day and got back a nice note, because in the book I indicate that McGovern is one of the fine men in government whom I admire.
One of the activists.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl Stokes, I've enjoyed very much talking to you, and not only talking to you, but reading about your life up till now in Promises of Power. Of course, we've only covered a small part of it here. So to our listeners, this political autobiography is worth buying. It's Simon & Schuster. Good luck on the book. And to those of us that have access to your NBC new career on television, we'll be watching you and see how you're coming along. Thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you.
This is Caspar Citrin saying goodbye from the Algonquin Hotel Cultural Rendezvous, West 44th Street here in New York City. I hope that you'll stay tuned in. Same time, same station, same places on the dial around the country. Goodbye from New York City.